Air travel has been hit hard as the government shutdown continues. How are airlines planning to deal with new FAA restrictions on flights?
Today is Thursday, November 6th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. After 20 terms in Congress, former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi won't be seeking another term. We'll examine the legacy of the first woman ever elected to the role.
They'll take the low road and I'll take the high road and I'll get to Congress before them.
And in Jamaica, volunteers and officials are still working toward recovery after catastrophic damage from Hurricane Melissa.
Somebody walked over an hour just to meet us and pick up some basic supplements, what they could carry by hand, because we couldn't get any further up the road.
Those stories and lots more after today's news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. President Trump says a Supreme Court ruling against his tariff policies would be catastrophic and hurt his ability to defend the country.
I think it would be devastating for our country, but I also think that we'll have to develop a game two plan. We'll see what happens.
Trump's comments come after conservative justices seemed skeptical of his authority to unilaterally impose tariffs on nearly every country in the world. Challengers say Trump is illegally using an emergency power to claim nearly limitless tariff power, and American small businesses are paying the price. The administration argues tariffs are part of the president's power to regulate trade. The head of the U.S. Postal Service says the federal mail agency has a new plan for cutting costs and boosting package deliveries in the coming year. As NPR's Hansi Lo Wong reports, the plan comes after the new leader of USPS spoke out against privatizing the country's mail service.
The U.S. Postal Service generally receives no tax dollars and relies instead on stamp and other service fees to keep running. And in a new video to postal workers, Postmaster General David Steiner says its financial situation is precarious.
No organization, even the Postal Service, can lose billions every year without consequence. Over the coming 12 months, we're going to act with urgency to get on a financially sustainable path.
With fewer people and businesses using first-class mail, Steiner says he wants to expand the Postal Service's package delivery service. USPS is still carrying out a reorganization plan that began under its previous leader, Louis DeJoy. The plan has led to stamp price increases, plus fewer mail pickups in many rural communities and longer delivery times. Hansi Lo Wong, NPR News.
The world's richest man, Elon Musk, is one step closer to becoming the world's first trillionaire. Tesla shareholders voted to give their CEO a pay package worth $1 trillion if he hits certain performance targets over the next decade. The vote followed weeks of debate over his management record and whether anyone deserved such an unprecedented windfall. Stocks fell sharply today on worries about the job market and possible overinvestment in tech companies. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average tumbled nearly 400 points, or 0.8%.
All the major stock indexes fell during the day, with the S&P 500 sliding 1.1% and the tech-heavy NASDAQ dropping almost 2%. Investors are nervous that the run-up in technology stocks, fueled by the artificial intelligence boom, could turn out to be overdone. Ordinarily, investors would have been looking for a report from the Labor Department this week on the job market, but that's been held up by the government shutdown. That's giving extra attention to other measures of the labor market, including a report from outplacement firm Challenger Gray & Christmas, which showed it was the worst October for layoff notices in more than two decades. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
The National Retail Federation predicts shoppers will spend over $1 trillion during the holiday season for the first time. This is NPR News. The International Criminal Court has confirmed war crime charges against Ugandan warlord Joseph Kony. The charges include murder, sexual enslavement, and rape while he led the brutal Lord's Resistance Army. Kony was thrust into the global spotlight in 2012 when a video about his actions went viral. For the trial to proceed, the ICC would need to have Kony in custody. Brazil's Congress has approved a new bill to exempt tens of millions of poor and middle-class workers from paying income tax while increasing taxes on the rich. The landmark tax reform was one of the leftist president's main campaign promises, as NPR's Carrie Kahn reports.
The bill allows Brazilians an exemption from taxes, raising the limit the poor and middle class can make to the equivalent of about $900 US a month. Previously, only those making less than about $500 a month were exempt. To make up the difference in lost income, the government will increase taxes on Brazil's top earners and their dividends. Supporters say it's common sense legislation. Those who have less pay less. Those who have more pay more. President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva is set to sign the bill, handing him a major political victory as he plans to run for re-election next year. Congress is still also looking to tax new outlets, including fintech companies and betting operators. Kerry Khan, NPR News, Rio de Janeiro.
A former Justice Department employee who threw a sandwich at a federal agent during President Trump's law enforcement surge in Washington, D.C., has been found not guilty of assault. A viral video made Sean Charles Dunn a symbol of resistance to Trump's deployment of federal agents. I'm Ryland Barton. You're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice at ajws.org.
It is 5:06, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from the First State Bank of Big Fork, with branches in Big Fork and Kellyer, offering tools for managing money on any mobile device. Hometown banking at its best since 1912. FSBBigFork.com. Member FDIC. And coming up at 5:30, it's going to be the Up North Report from our KAXE KBXE news team. Now we'll take you back to All Things Considered.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. There will be fewer planes in the air tomorrow as a consequence of the ongoing government shutdown. The Federal Aviation Administration has announced that it will eventually reduce air traffic by 10% at 40 of the nation's busiest airports starting Friday. The rationale is safety. Air traffic controllers are federal employees who are required to work without pay during the shutdown, and that has made a staffing shortage worse, and the FAA has already been delaying flights because of it. But there are still a lot of questions about how all of this will work, so for some answers, we've reached United Airlines Chief Customer Officer and Senior Vice President of Airport Operations, David Kenzelman. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I know that this news, David, is fresh to you, but as best as you know, what exactly might this look like for United? Do you plan to cancel flights, delay them? What measures are you taking?
We do plan to cancel flights. Over the next few days, we are canceling about 4% of our domestic flying. But it'll be a spread across the airports, and we will put those cancellations in today for the weekend because we know customers will want to know before they depart whether the return flight will be impacted. So you'll see those cancellations going in today.
As United has been making those decisions, how involved has the FAA been in sort of guiding and shaping them?
They've given us a list of airports where they feel like airlines could help them relieve pressure. Each of the airlines are making reductions in those airports to help to provide relief for the air traffic controllers to ensure safety and reliable transportation for customers.
How much advance notice did you get to need to make these changes from the FAA and the Department of Transportation?
It came pretty quickly, to be honest, but this is what we do. We have service disruptions frequently in the airline business. It could be storms, it could be staffing triggers, it could be any external variable. We do this fairly frequently, so we've got a good playbook. Just to put it in perspective, the impact here is about what we would expect from a medium-sized storm. The difference is it's spread across the entire domestic network, and so that's a little bit easier for us to manage, okay, given our schedule.
Now, the air traffic controller staffing shortage that we've been discussing, that really predates the government shutdown. Has United already been making flight decisions due to capacity concerns at certain busy airports?
There are a few airports where we have had to make those decisions, but generally speaking, we're flying the schedule that we publish, and we're working very closely with the FAA and whatever resource constraints they may have in a certain location to accommodate customers as best we can. You've seen some increase in delays in certain markets where that's happened, but generally we've been able to keep up with it and provide reliable transportation.
You know, I think for a lot of us, we have unanswered questions about the safety when we fly. I wonder from your vantage point, state. Do you believe this 10% reduction in air traffic will make air travel appreciably safer for United customers?
We are complying with the request from FAA, and we believe that the air traffic control system is extremely safe. We do everything we can every day to ensure that we deliver safe and reliable transportation to customers, and we work with the federal agencies to ensure that. So this is an important point for us to get ahead of the capacity constraints here that we're putting into place and try to minimize the impact to customers on their travel.
I just want to ask again, though, the 10% reduction, will it make air travel safer for passengers?
Right now, we're focused on what we know, which is about a 4% reduction over the next few days, and making sure we communicate with customers in advance, provide them travel options so that we can minimize their disruption.
You and other airlines have announced that international flights are not being affected by this move at this point. Why not?
Well, that's right. Our long-haul international flights and the flights that we have between our seven hubs are not impacted by this. And the reason is really important. The first is those are heavy volume for customers. They carry a lot of connections and they carry a lot of crews where we transport crews from one flight to another. So in order to minimize the disruption for United's network for days to come, we want to be sure we preserve the integrity of those routes.
I mean, as you all know, Thanksgiving is a few weeks away, and that's traditionally one of the busiest travel times of the year. Christmas comes very soon after that. If this government shutdown continues, how are you preparing for that?
Well, we're focused now on what we know, and that is what the schedule reductions look like in the next few days. The good point, if there is a silver lining here, is that we are not in peak travel period now. We're not in the middle of the holidays. We're not in the middle of the summer. And so we're pretty confident. United's got a large network, and we're confident that we'll have the seats available to accommodate customers on their journeys.
David, I do have to ask you to put on your chief customer hat for a second here. What's your advice for travelers who are planning to fly in the coming days?
The primary advice I would have is to download the United app. That's our primary channel for communicating everything about the customer's journey, whether it's disruptions of flights or whether it's options for amenities along the way. Every update that we have, we will be as transparent as we can about those changes through the app. So travel can be stressful, but prior to travel, if they download the app, that's the best source of providing a good way for us to communicate the disposition of their travel journey.
We've been speaking with David Kinzelman, United Airlines Chief Customer Officer and Senior Vice President of Airport Operations. Thanks so much.
You're welcome, Juana. Thanks for having me.
It was the most powerful storm in Jamaica's history. Last week, Hurricane Melissa tore through the island and other Caribbean nations. Jamaican officials say the storm caused at least $7 billion worth of damage to the country's infrastructure and business sectors. Now, aid groups are on the ground. More of them are turning up. But as NPR's Fatma Tanis reports, they're struggling to reach people in need.
It's hard enough to respond to the aftermath of a Category 5 hurricane, but it's even harder when it's an island.
The first access difficulty is getting things in.
Francesco Paganini is with Greater Goods Charities. He says food, water, and hygiene kits need to be flown in or shipped from warehouses outside the island. Then there's the issue of roads. Paganini is on the ground and says it seems as though every tree and power line has been toppled, blocking roads.
Somebody walked over an hour just to meet us and pick up some basic supplements, what they could carry by hand, because we couldn't get any further up the road.
Nearly 3 million people live in Jamaica, and half the island's population needs help. The State Department this week announced it's sending $12 million in assistance to Jamaica and another $12 million to Haiti, Cuba, and the Bahamas. But aid experts say a lot more is needed. And with the Trump administration's dismantling of USAID, the lead federal agency for international disaster relief, the U.S. doesn't have the same capacity to help that it used to. Alexis Macharelli is with the World Food Program. He says the damage wasn't only to people's homes, but to Jamaica's ecosystem as well.
There was this massive sea surge and just took away everything. And now with obviously the seawater, salty water, everything gets burned. The nature is all brown. There's not a green leaf left.
He says Jamaica's breadbasket, the center of its fishing and agriculture industry, was decimated. Francesco Paganini says his organization was worried about the destroyed trees and crops, so they called up beekeepers on the island.
It may sound silly that, why are we worried about bees at this point? But you don't produce food without pollinators, and bees are the biggest pollinators.
Paganini found out the bees were in fact starving from the lack of nectar and pollen. His organization is now shipping synthetic pollen from the U.S. to feed the bees. Both he and Masciarelli say the impact of the storm will be felt for many months to come. Fatma Tanis, NPR News.
Thanks to some newly implemented rules, there's a surge of fresh faces in the top 10 Billboard charts. NPR Music's Stephen Thompson has our report.
A few weeks ago, Billboard made it easier to remove declining songs from its Hot 100 singles chart. In a flash, moldy old hits by Teddy Swims, Benson Boone, and Lady Gaga dropped off the chart. The rule change was meant to freshen up the Hot 100 and make room for new faces. But the effects of the change have been obscured by the success of two blockbuster albums, Taylor Swift's The Life of a Showgirl and the soundtrack to K-pop Demon Hunters, still account for 19 of the top 40 songs. Now their grip on the Hot 100 is starting to loosen. Those albums' hit singles hold down the top two spots, but the deep cuts have been sliding out of the top 10. Between that and the rules changes, we're finally seeing some new faces. In the past 2 weeks, three artists have entered the top 10 for the first time in their careers. The English singer Olivia Dean is at number 5 with her breakout hit, Man I Need. Leon Thomas is at number 10 with his sleeper sensation, Mutt. And this week, Kehlani joins them as Folded leaps to number 7 on the strength of a series of remixes. Before the rules change, just 6 acts had experienced their first top 10 single in 2025, and 2 of those are fictional groups from K-pop Demon Hunters. The others are Alex Warren, Doechii, Big X The Plug, and Raven Lanae. Another rising star looks primed to join them in the top 10 soon. Back to Friends, a breakout hit for the Gen Z singer-songwriter Somber, just jumped to number 12. Stephen Thompson, NPR Music.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is The Set List on KAXE, where we highlight live music around the area for the upcoming week. I'm Malachi Coons. We are taking a look at 5 shows this week, November 6th through the 8th, in Gilbert, Grand Rapids, Nisswa, and Bemidji. First up, Rich Mattson is performing solo at the Ore House in Gilbert Thursday at 6 p.m. The Minnesota music scene veteran of bands like The Bitter Spills, Glenn Russell's, Ole Yeller, Tired Eyes, and many more is still going strong with his current band, the North Stars. He plays solo sets every first Thursday at the Ore House in Gilbert. On Friday, Michaela James is playing at Rapids Brewing in Grand Rapids at 6 o'clock. She is a singer-songwriter from Rapids who is currently based in the Twin Cities. She specializes in acoustic sets with guitar and ukulele. Michaela James at Rapids Brewing this Friday. Annie Humphrey and the Fire in the Village Collective have 2 stops on their fall music and arts tour this weekend. On Friday, they will be at their Room 203 space at the Old Central School in Grand Rapids, part of the First Friday Art Walk. Then on Saturday, they will be at Headwaters Music and Arts in Bemidji. Concerts with Humphrey are both days at 7 p.m., with additional arts events and gathering time during the day. The theme for the fall tour is the Warriors and the Powerless. One More Show is the latest in the Grassroots Concert Series in Nisswa. Folk singer Kelly Hunt is playing at 7 p.m. Friday night. Based in New Orleans, Hunt's music draws from a wide range of influences, like the classic folk of Joni Mitchell, blues of Mississippi John Hurt, and even classical composers. It's Kelly Hunt this Friday at the Journey Church in Nisswa. The set list is made possible by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
It is 529, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingel. Coming up next is the Up North Report. Support for KAXE comes from Atchison Tire in Grand Rapids, providing service and offering tire brands like Bridgestone, Firestone, and Toyo. Serving the area since 1916, more at AtchisonTire.com. And weather tonight, chance of rain, cloudy with temps in the low to mid-30s.
And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. The Trump administration says it has struck two more deals with the pharmaceutical industry as part of its push to get lower drug prices for Americans. This time, they involve the popular and expensive obesity drugs made by Eli Lilly and Novo Nordisk. But who really benefits and what does it mean for consumers? NPR Pharmaceuticals correspondent Sydney Lupkin is here with us. Hi there.
Hi, Juana.
Sydney, let's start at the beginning with today's deals. What do we need to know?
Yeah, the centerpiece of the deals is blockbuster drugs for type 2 diabetes and obesity. So Ozempic, Wegovy, Mounjaro, and Zepbound. It expands coverage to some, but not all, Medicare beneficiaries with obesity. They have to have additional health conditions or a body mass index over 35. People with Medicare will be able to get them for a copay of $50 a month. State Medicaid programs will have to opt in, but the lower cost of the drugs to the government, $245 per patient per month, is something that I'm hearing will likely push them toward this. And the drug companies win too, even though they're taking a hit on prices. Here's economist Jeffrey Joyce, the director of health policy at the USC Schaefer Center.
I think the manufacturers were open to this partly for political reasons, but also it was just going to expand their patient population dramatically.
And that means overall more revenue for the drug companies.
Okay, but what about people who aren't on Medicare and Medicaid? Does this help them at all?
It could. The companies had already been offering the drugs at a discount for people not using their insurance, and that mostly helps people who don't already have coverage for these drugs. So as part of today's announcement, those direct-to-consumer prices will come down a bit more, and the drugs will be part of TrumpRx.gov. That's a new website the administration is launching before the end of the year. There are also two obesity pills on the horizon awaiting FDA approval. If they're approved, the companies have promised to launch them at $149 for the starting dose for Medicare, Medicaid, and TrumpRx.
And if I understand correctly, this is one of several deals on pharmaceuticals that the Trump administration struck in the last few months, right?
Exactly. The deals are part of a broader initiative the administration calls Most Favored Nation Drug Pricing. It's an attempt to lower American drug prices and get the same or lower prices as other developed countries. A lot of the stuff about the obesity drugs is unique to the administration's arrangements with Novo Nordisk and Eli Lilly. That said, today's deals also included similar terms to deals with Pfizer and AstraZeneca, such as a 3-year exemption from certain tariffs. The companies agreed to lower prices in Medicaid and launch new drugs in the U.S. at the same price as in other developed countries. Drug makers also agreed to offer lower prices of some drugs sold directly to consumers online and through TrumpRx. A third deal with the company EMD Serono was a little different. It didn't involve Medicaid and only offered direct-to-consumer discounts on the company's fertility drugs, but not its cancer or multiple sclerosis drugs.
So, Sydney, it sounds to me like perhaps there are limitations to what these deals can do for patients.
That's right. These aren't necessarily lower prices for everyone, and they're not on all drugs. In fact, if you have insurance, a lot of the drugs could be cheaper for you by paying your copay than going through TrumpRx. But it might be helpful if your insurance doesn't cover a drug you want and it's available through the administration's website.
NPR Pharmaceuticals correspondent Sydney Lupkin, thank you.
You bet.
Among the many federal projects in limbo during this government shutdown, planetary science. That means things like analyzing giant asteroids, or studying the magnetosphere of Jupiter, or better understanding Mars so that we humans might one day visit. NPR's Katie O'Riddle reports.
A couple decades ago, scientists discovered an asteroid that looked like it was on track to come unusually close to the Earth. Dani Della Giustina is a planetary scientist. She's part of the mission that's studying this asteroid.
When it was discovered in 2004, there was an initial scare that it might impact the Earth.
Maybe even crash into our planet. They named this potential Earth destroyer Apophis.
The name Apophis comes from the Egyptian god of chaos.
Eventually, scientists determined the god of chaos would not be destroying the Earth, but it is on track to pass by it in just a few years. That presents a rare opportunity to get a close look at it. Their mission to send a spacecraft to study this asteroid is called OSIRIS-APEX. That spacecraft is already en route to Apophis. When President Trump's proposed budget came out for 2026, funding for OSIRIS-APEX was not in it.
We were one of many projects that was slated for cancellation as part of that proposal.
To be clear, the president's budget is not final. It's more of a wish list. Once it comes out, Congress decides on funding for line item programs through the appropriations process. Della Giustina and the other scientists mounted a campaign to save OSIRIS-APEX. Apophis is big, at least in terms of asteroids that happen to be taking a stroll through our neighborhood. It's as wide as the Empire State Building is tall.
An object of this size only gets so close to the Earth about once every 7,500 years. So we have really just this one opportunity to send a spacecraft there to study it.
The scientists wanted to see how Earth's gravity, sunlight, and geology will affect the asteroid when it gets close. Among other things, if we ever do encounter an asteroid that's on track to destroy Earth, having met this one in person will give us some idea of what we're dealing with. She says to the elected officials they spoke with, this was a persuasive argument.
And that is, I think, why we were able to garner such incredible support from both sides of the aisle.
Their allies in Congress signaled they would push back against the president's request. But the mission's future is still not a guarantee until the government opens again and passes an official budget that includes designated funding. Some people on other missions say they are feeling even less confident about their future.
What the actual financial situation is up in the air.
Fran Baganall is an astrophysicist at the University of Colorado. She works on the Juno mission, studying Jupiter. Insight into the largest planet, she says, helps us understand formation of the entire solar system. She says she hasn't received any communication on whether or not the mission will be extended. She's heard it might be negotiated into the budget.
Whether or not they actually are in or not in is speculation as far as I can tell.
Baganall oversees a group of students who help her study the data they're receiving from Jupiter. They're using it to map the composition of the planet. They are the first ones to handle this raw data from space. She says there's no finer training for students than this real-life experience.
This is the process of growing up into science and technology that has a value to society as a whole.
Grant money from NASA ran out for the mission at the end of September. Baganall says since then, she's been using what's left of her funding to keep paying her students a stipend for this work. She believes the instability to the field, caused in part by this shutdown, is taking a toll.
We are bleeding young scientists like crazy. They're leaving, going back to other countries or going into other jobs.
Funding for Juno could still come through after the government reopens. NASA did not respond to an interview request for the story. Regardless, says Baganall.
Even if the government opens again soon, the damage will have been done.
She says this is about more than the exploration of space. It's about allowing future generations to continue to pursue their curiosities about the natural world. Katie Riddle, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
It is 529, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. Coming up next is the Up North Report. We receive support from the Move It Real Estate Group, assisting clients with real estate purchases and sales for over 25 years, not only in Grand Rapids, but across northern Minnesota. Move to what moves you. More at moveitrealestate.com. Weather tonight, cloudy skies with a slight chance of rain, lows 29 to 35 degrees, southeast winds 5 to 15 miles per hour.
For KAXE News, I'm Larissa Donovan with the Up North Report. Library and museum funding updates were first on the Beltrami County Board of Commissioners work session agenda Tuesday. Citizens, some dressed as their favorite books or literary characters, turned out in support of the Bemidji Public Library, which may be facing a drastic reduction in hours and staff next year due to budget cuts. Melissa Watley with the Kichigami Regional Library System offered the Beltrami County Board an alternative to the 40% reduction to Bemidji and Black Ducks libraries.
We would like to request and propose a meet me halfway option with the Beltrami County Board.
Kichigami's proposal includes releasing some of its reserves for offsetting levy requests in exchange for Beltrami County increasing the budget to the library by $81,000. The county budgeted nearly $438,000 for Beltrami County's libraries in the Kichigami system in 2025, but reduced that to $265,000 for next year, which is considered the minimum maintenance of effort to participate in a regional library system. Regional libraries are required to operate at least 20 hours per week. Since Black Ducks Library only operates 21 hours a week, Watley says most of the cuts will be felt at the Bemidji branch. The preliminary county budget set in September also cuts the $7,500 in funding to the Beltrami County History Museum. That cut represents about 10% of the center's annual operating budget. But the museum has since secured a private donation to cover the difference. Executive Director Emily Thaves also shared a major grant announcement.
For the very first time that we have secured private grant funding for the complete redesign of our permanent exhibits.
The Beltrami County Historical Society is seeking advisory committee members for the project, with interested people encouraged to apply by November 30th. County Administrator Tom Berry says expected cost shifts from state and federal sources are forcing all departments to make adjustments.
We're going without police vehicles. We're reducing our staff. We're reducing all of these things as an operation. And the board had made a decision with these budget principles and priorities that we're going to have to constrain our budget to work within our means and focus the limited resources we have on the county.
Beltrami County will host its annual Truth in Taxation hearing at 6 p.m. on December 2nd, where members of the public can comment on the proposed budget and levy. Hundreds packed into Forest View Middle School in Baxter on Saturday, largely to oppose MnDOT's plans for the Highway 371 overpass of Highway 210. The Brainerd Dispatch reports many are concerned with the proposed button hook design, which includes five new roundabouts and two bridges. Attendees told MnDOT engineers and the Baxter City Council that they are worried about business access, the main business district's economy, and the character of the city. The design is MnDOT's preferred option for the complicated intersection of two busy highways, railroad tracks, and frontage roads. Those opposed say the proposed design would make Baxter feel more like the Twin Cities, not the gateway to the lakes area it aims to be. Business owners express concern over construction impacts and future access, and community members say the project is designed around tourist traffic that only affects the area in the summer. The Baxter City Council has 90 days to approve or deny MnDOT's plan. The City of Walker announced it is accepting applications to fill a vacancy on its City Council. The Walker City Council accepted the resignation of fellow member Char Moore last month. The Walker City Council members have four-year terms, and Moore began her most recent term in January. On its official Facebook page, the City of Walker says the appointed council member would serve until December 2026. A special election would then select a candidate to fill the remaining 2 years of the term. Requirements include being a qualified city voter who is at least 21 years old and a resident of the city for at least 30 days. Walker City Council members earn a $600 monthly stipend. Interested Walker residents can apply online or by stopping into Walker City Hall before noon on November 26th. That's it for the Up North Report. Find more of our stories and photos at KAXE.org, where you can also find content from our music, phonology, and morning show teams. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Larissa Donovan, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is made possible by Woodland Bank, serving the area since 1920, with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River. Woodland Bank believes in building community and serving local nonprofits like KAXE.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Workday. Workday is an AI platform for forward thinkers dedicated to transforming the way business leaders manage people, money, and agents today so they can transform tomorrow. Workday, moving business forever forward. And from the NPR Wine Club, now shipping to additional states. Whether purchasing a few wines or joining the wine club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Democratic Representative Nancy Pelosi, the first woman ever elected Speaker of the House, announced today that she will not seek another term. Pelosi spent 38 years representing her San Francisco constituents in Washington. KQED senior politics correspondent Scott Schaefer looks back at her historic legacy.
As Representative Nancy Pelosi prepares to exit the political stage at age 85, she leaves behind a long list of accomplishments, including passage of the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. Pelosi was first elected in 1987 to fill a seat left vacant by the death of Representative Sala Burton. Her first campaign was no cakewalk. Some of her opponents painted her as privileged and out of touch, including City Supervisor Carol Rue Silver at a televised debate held at KQED.
How can she relate to people like me, a single parent working mother?
But Pelosi held her ground.
My attitude is they'll take the low road and I'll take the high road and I'll get to Congress before them.
And she did, quickly showing her political chops. Years later, her reputation as a tough-as-nails street fighter was well-established, as she acknowledged in 2018.
As I always say to the candidates, you have to know how to take a punch and throw a punch.
Pelosi arrived in Washington as the AIDS epidemic was ravaging her district. She pushed for more federal funding at a time when the Reagan administration was ignoring it. Ernest Hopkins with the San Francisco AIDS Foundation said Pelosi's impact was felt far outside her own district.
She understood that we could not end the HIV epidemic without addressing the epidemic in Black and Latino communities, and so she was all in.
But Pelosi's rise to power within the Democratic Party was not easy.
And when I did run for high office and leadership, some of the men said, "Who said she could run?" Well, that just lit my fire, really.
In 2006, Democrats reclaimed a majority in the House for the first time in 12 years. They elected Pelosi to be the next speaker. Pelosi was a partisan warrior, but Republicans used her as a foil, a liberal Democrat from San Francisco, tying her to other Democrats running in more conservative parts of the country. There were times when she worked across the aisle. During the last year of George W. Bush's presidency, when the economy was cratering from the subprime mortgage crisis, she rounded up enough Democratic votes to save financial institutions, which critics described as a Wall Street bailout. Even former Republican Speaker John Boehner praised her at the unveiling of Pelosi's official portrait in 2022.
And the fact of the matter is, no other Speaker of the House in the modern era, Republican or Democrat, has wielded the gavel with such authority or with such consistent results.
Pelosi's superpower was cultivating relationships and understanding how to win enough votes to pass legislation. She was also a thorn in the side of President Trump. In a meeting in the Oval Office during Trump's first term, Pelosi said the blame belonged squarely on the president if there were a government shutdown.
You should not have a Trump shutdown. You have them at the White House.
A photo of her emerging from that meeting with the president wearing a vibrant red coat and sunglasses became an iconic image. Democrats retook the House in 2019, and Pelosi was elected Speaker a second time, guiding two impeachments of Trump, efforts that ultimately failed in the Senate. She became the face of the Democratic Party's resistance, dramatically ripping up a copy of Trump's State of the Union speech in 2020. She later gave her reason in an interview with KQED, saying it was, quote, full of lies. Pelosi made history as the first woman and the first Californian to become Speaker. But as Governor Gavin Newsom notes, it's what she did with that power that mattered.
You may never get something like this back. It will take 40, 50 years for someone to build the kind of credibility that she's built and the influence and the capacity to deliver.
Several candidates are already vying to replace her. Whoever wins will be hard-pressed to match Pelosi's ability to wield power. For NPR News, I'm Scott Schaefer in San Francisco.
Sometimes we buy things we later regret spending money on. That new sweater that falls apart after one wear, or maybe that fabulous-looking vase that turns out to be a mass-produced dupe. In the moment, it can be really hard to resist the temptation of making a purchase. So we're going to explore how to avoid buyer's remorse. This is part of our ongoing series, The Cost of Living, The Price We Pay. Marielle Segata is host of NPR's Life Kit, and she is here to walk us through what we should do, what we should think about before we buy. Hey, Marielle.
Hey, Mary Louise.
Okay, so I'm at the store or I'm online and I'm browsing and I'm just about to click and put something in my cart. First thing, what should I stop and do?
Pause. Just take a beat, check in with yourself. Sometimes we shop when we want to feel something. You know, we want to feel creatively inspired. We're just bored. We want to be stimulated. Or you might also shop when you're feeling too much. You're sad, you're hungry, angry, lonely, tired. There's actually an acronym to help you remember that. It's called HALT. People might know it from Alcoholics Anonymous, but it applies here too. Basically, you just want to check in and say, what am I feeling in my body right now? And is shopping the best way to meet that need or desire?
And then what next?
Yeah, then you can ask yourself, do I need this thing or do I just want it? And there is nothing wrong with wanting something, but when you separate out your needs from your wants and you're really honest about that, that can help you prioritize spending when you do have limited funds. And, you know, most of us do.
Unfortunately, alas, tis true. Okay, so say I've done everything you recommend. I've done the whole emotional check-in. Are there other just practical questions to stop and ask myself?
For sure. Yeah, you want to ask, does this item fit with my lifestyle? Do I have anywhere to put it? If it's an appliance, like a dishwasher, what is the installation going to cost? Also, am I willing to do what it takes to own this thing? Can I maintain it? Can I keep up with repairs? What would repairs even entail? And then, of course, you want to shop around. You want to do your research, look at product reviews. Also, make sure you're considering a mix of opinions and using resources you trust and places you know how they come up with their ratings. And then when you think about price, just remember that more expensive doesn't necessarily mean better. I talked to Brian Vines from Consumer Reports, and they have dozens of laboratories where they test out products.
The price does not guarantee performance. We've seen that over and over again, and we test for reliability. And sometimes the repair costs on these high-end brands outpace replacement costs on mid-range brands.
I mean, and then also you just want to remember, sometimes the best purchasing choice you can make is walking away. Vines put it this way.
If it's not what you want and what is going to fit into your life, walk away, because they're still making stuff 24 hours a day and someone is going to make the thing that you want the way you want it at a price that you're willing to pay.
Yeah. And this is something I do when I'm buying clothing and shoes, right? Mm. If it's at all uncomfortable, if it's pinching me even a little bit, it is going back on the rack.
That is wisdom and great advice there from Marielle Segata, our Life Kit host. Marielle, I'm prepared to listen to you on everything but shoes. Can shoes be exempt from this?
You like uncomfortable shoes?
I like all shoes. I'll just take them.
That's a vibe. That's a vibe.
Thanks so much. Great to talk to you.
You too.
And as our series on the cost of living continues, we explore the forces behind the rising price of furniture. You can hear that on All Things Considered Saturday.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. For more than a month, Senate Democrats have voted against a Republican measure to reopen the government as they fight for an extension of expiring health insurance subsidies. Earlier this week, some signaled they were looking for an off-ramp, but election victories Tuesday night have emboldened many Democrats to press on, even as pain from the shutdown grows. NPR congressional reporter Sam Greenglass explains why Democrats think the public is on their side.
In 2018, Andy Kim ran for a Republican-held congressional district in New Jersey. The incumbent, Tom MacArthur, was a key player in GOP efforts to repeal and replace Obamacare.
Everyone was furious. I mean, he really touched the third rail.
That year in Michigan, Democrat Alyssa Slotkin also challenged a Republican incumbent, and she also says health care was the dominant issue.
My experience with my mom not having insurance when she was diagnosed with stage 4 ovarian cancer just meant that a lot of people wanted to talk about it, and I had a lot to say on the issue in my first race.
Kim and Slotkin flipped the seats, and along with other first-time candidates running on health care, helped sweep Democrats back into the House majority. Also in that cohort, Abigail Spanberger and Mikey Sherrill, who this week were elected governor in Virginia and New Jersey. 8 years later, Slotkin and Kim are in the Senate, and Democrats are holding out for Affordable Care Act subsidies, betting health care will again fuel a midterm blue wave. Open enrollment began November 1st, when many Americans discovered their ACA premiums are going to skyrocket, including in Michigan.
That's 500,000 people in my state alone. You're talking about people who are going to be doubling their costs and then deciding not to keep health care coverage.
Ashley Kurzinger has been polling the subsidies for health organization KFF.
I think what's really telling is that we see not just majorities, but large majorities of Republicans, independents, and Democrats saying that they want Congress to extend the enhanced premium tax credits.
Kurzinger says Obamacare itself is more popular than ever, a sea change from 15 years ago when Americans were deeply divided over the law.
The best thing that happened to the Affordable Care Act politically was when Republicans started trying to take it away.
That's Meredith Kelly, a former staffer at the Democratic Congressional Committee. Before the 2018 cycle, Kelly worried Obamacare would be a political liability. But then, with President Trump in office, Republicans moved to gut it.
I think the 2018 cycle was a massive turning point for the popularity of the ACA. Democrats worked really hard to help Americans understand what Republicans were ripping away.
Hustling to yet another funding vote, Slotkin says it's hard to guarantee health care will play the same role it did in 2018. But she thinks there's a good chance it will.
Among all the major ways people are paying more and the cost of living is going up, I can't think of something that's more personal.
Republicans say the subsidies are just papering over soaring health care costs and have accused Democrats of holding the government hostage to show they're standing up to Trump, leaving federal workers and SNAP beneficiaries in the lurch. Not all Democrats think the consequences are worth it. Senator Catherine Cortez Masto of Nevada has been voting with Republicans to reopen the government.
I don't think we should swap the pain of some Americans for others. I think we can keep the government open and address this looming crisis of the health care cliff that we are seeing.
This week, a few more Democrats have signaled they may accept just the promise of a vote to extend the subsidies. Others still want something more ironclad. For now, the shutdown continues, and the subsidies are still set to expire. Sam Greenglass, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 5:48, and you're tuned in to All Things Considered here on KAXE, KBXE. My name is Andrew DeZingle. Support comes from Headwaters Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Bemidji, gathering at 10 a.m. on Sundays now through May at the Headwaters Peace Center. HUF is an inclusive space to seek truth, practice love, and celebrate life. Learn more at headwatersuu.org. The KAXE News Team put together a list of food-related resources across northern Minnesota. You'll find hours of operation and locations of food shelves, along with information on soup kitchens and community meals. Visit KAXE.org to find the list. If you have something to add, email news@KAXE.org. We receive support from Hug Hydronics, committed to making in-floor heating simple, providing in-floor heating solutions for both commercial and residential. More information at hughydronics.com. Pine River Market Square has their last market of the year, Saturday, November 8th from 10 to 2. Indoors at the warehouse located on Norway Avenue. Find local produce, baked goods, crafts, and more. The Itasca Ski and Outing Club has a grand opening for its new Minnesota Ski Jumping Museum, Saturday, November 8th from noon to 4 at Mount Itasca near Coleraine. See historic artifacts and learn about local champions and Olympians. Watermark Art Center in Bemidji opens the annual It's Only Clay exhibit Friday, November 7th with a reception from 5 to 7. Awards and presentations begin at 5:30. The exhibit is on display through December 23rd. Kotaska Community Action offers free lunch every Wednesday from 11 to 1 at their Circles of Support office, located across from Treasure Bay Printing on Northeast 4th Street in Grand Rapids. They also offer a food pantry from 11 to 2, Monday through Thursday. Now we'll take you back to All Things Considered.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. For decades, Israel has enjoyed strong support from American conservatives. Now some prominent influencers on the political right are questioning that support. NPR's Jeff Brumfield has more on what's driving the change and what it could mean.
Red State America has been a fan of Israel. Just ask Jackson Lahmeyer, an evangelical pastor in Oklahoma.
In the past, everyone that was in our Christian conservative circles, you just assumed everybody supported Israel.
That evangelical support is deeply rooted in faith, he says. But recently, Lahmeyer has noticed the conversation is changing quite a bit, particularly online.
Some very influential leaders, all of whom I like, Tucker Carlson, Candace Owens, Marjorie Taylor Greene, have taken a very controversial stance in regards to the nation of Israel that has actually been more of a Democratic Party platform item.
Like in August, when Tucker Carlson interviewed a nun from the West Bank about the suffering of Palestinian Christians. Carlson said he wanted to raise awareness among Americans.
Israel couldn't exist without the United States. And it has the support of so many Christians in the United States. And I don't know if they're fully aware. Think they would care if they knew.
The war in Gaza has prompted other prominent Republicans like Steve Bannon to raise criticisms of Israel. Kurt Mills is editor of the American Conservative magazine. He says many of these personalities never supported Israel, and they sense now is the moment to speak up.
Tucker and Bannon are political operators and in a lot of ways true believers, but they are also very effective businessmen, and they would not be doing these programs if nobody gave a hoot. There's an audience for this. People are frustrated. People are angry, and they have reason to be.
That frustration is about more than just suffering in Gaza, Mills says. Many conservatives want America to avoid becoming entangled in new wars, particularly in the Middle East. And they worry the Trump administration is allowing Israel to drive military decisions, like America's attack on Iran earlier this year.
They are using Donald Trump's presidency like a rented car. The Israelis, the Israel lobby, the Netanyahu government, the neoconservatives in his ranks.
So outrage over the war in Gaza and the America First agenda are driving some of this conservative opposition to Israel. But there's something else. Anti-Semitic conspiracies. Take, for example, this comment podcaster Candace Owens made about a recent meeting between Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and a group of U.S. social media influencers.
2 years ago, the mere idea that you might share a perspective that Jews are controlling the media, that would be considered anti-Semitic. You would be called a Jew hater. Fast forward to 2025, and Bibi Netanyahu is now hosting an on-camera meeting.
The idea that Jews control the media is a long-held anti-Semitic trope. Owens has made other anti-Semitic remarks in the past, though she has repeatedly said that she does not hate Jewish people. And just last week, Tucker Carlson hosted Nick Fuentes, a white nationalist who is called Hitler awesome.
I'm going to just shut up. And you tell me what you actually believe.
Yeah. Fuentes went on to make numerous anti-Semitic statements, including that he believed Jews were more faithful to Israel than the countries they were born in, and that Jewish people prevent America from unifying around a common vision for itself.
The main challenge to that, a big challenge to that, is organized Jewry in America.
Carlson's interview with Fuentes sparked a firestorm on the right. Some Republicans blasted him for giving Fuentes a platform, while others, like the president of the Conservative Heritage Foundation, supported Carlson's right to have an open dialogue. Why is this happening now? Shibley Talhami is a scholar at the University of Maryland who tracks public opinion about Israel.
Among Republicans, there's still support for Israel. That is really the core support for Israel right now. But what we've seen is really a shift.
He says the Gaza war has damaged Israel's image, particularly with young conservatives. A Pew poll this spring found the number of Republicans under 50 with an unfavorable view of Israel has jumped 15 points since 2022. Talhami's own work shows that only 24% of young Republicans sympathize with Israel in the current conflict. And separate polling has also showed that younger conservatives are more likely to agree with anti-Semitic statements than other groups. Put it all together, and he says influencers are free to speak up.
These people who are critics of Israel on the right feel more empowered because they now see that even public opinion is on their side among the young generation Republicans.
It remains to be seen what this actually means for America's relationship with Israel. American Ambassador Mike Huckabee is a devout evangelical Christian, and the Trump administration continues to be broadly supportive.
The question, of course, is whether the shift in public opinion in and of itself would lead to a shift in policy. And that's not a straightforward line.
But it is clear that on the American right, support for Israel is no longer the given it once was. Jeff Brumfiel, NPR News.
One of the Roman Empire's biggest achievements was its infrastructure. Rome sponsored colossal projects, the Colosseum among them. It also built ports, amphitheaters, and aqueducts.
Right, but the empire's widest reaching project was the construction of a sprawling road system across Europe, North Africa, and the Middle East.
Everyone knows Roman roads are kind of a big deal. We even have proverbs that say all roads lead to Rome.
Tom Brookmans is a Roman archaeologist at Aarhus University in Denmark. In a study out today in the journal Scientific Data, he and his colleagues present a new roadmap of the Roman world.
We created that first highly detailed and open, accountable resource showing where are all of the roads of the Roman Empire.
Their map includes more than 180,000 miles of Roman roads. That is enough to circle the Earth more than seven times, and it includes tens of thousands of miles of newly identified roads. Brookman says it took a lot of sleuthing to make this map. Remember that most of these roads, they don't exist anymore. They've faded away or they've been paved over.
So to construct this map, the researchers used known Roman cities and towns and villages as starting points.
It's kind of like playing this continental scale game of connecting the dots. The way in which we went about it was using loads of satellite imagery as well as topographic maps.
Then they cross-referenced all that with ancient Roman maps and records. Brookmans says many of the major roads from the Roman Empire overlap with modern-day highways and roads cutting through Europe.
And he also says this new data will help historians study how religion, migration, trade, and even pandemics spread across the Roman Empire 2,000 years ago.
Disease can travel along strongly. Held belief can travel along, innovations can travel along, right? Those things, they happen over the roads. The road structure, how that disease could be transmitted, how those people migrated. And so this resource will be really valuable for increasing our understanding of these really important phenomena.
The map can also be used for less practical applications.
You can ask these kind of GPS questions of like, how do I get from Antioch to Rome on a donkey, for example?
To which the answer is 33 and a half days of nonstop donkey travel. So good luck.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from AT&T, a network that is making connections for Americans. Connecting changes everything. Learn more at att.com/YATT. From Drexel University, whose cooperative education program positions students to explore future careers before graduation. This is experiential education. More at drexel.edu. From Fidelity Investments, a dedicated advisor can help build a comprehensive wealth plan. Learn more at fidelity.com/wealth. Investment minimums apply. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids and 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Listen at KAXE.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you. We receive support from the Lake Country Journal, a local lifestyle magazine sharing stories about places to go, things to do, and people to know in Lake Country. More at lakecountryjournal.com. Bemidji community members will hold a tailgate pantry Saturday, November 8th from 3 to 5 p.m. in the parking lot of the Paul Bunyan Mall near Hobby Lobby. Bring or take shelf-stable food or hygiene items. Now it's time for As It Happens.